Before we get started, I'm just going to go ahead and apologize that we both sound a little nasally today. It appears that our part of Texas decided to get covered in pollen and bad weather.
Yeah, there's like rivers of pollen outside.
It's pretty bad, and it seems that our allergies have been fighting us a little bit all week long.
So no, that's not Barry White on the recording. That's just us.
Yes, and which also means that my editing will probably take a little bit longer because I'll probably have to edit out sniffles and everything else. So it's
I think we should just leave them in there.
Just to let everybody can see what life with us is like right now.
Yeah.
There you go. But this is Educating Technology, a podcast where we talk about using technology in our schools. I'm your host, Matthew Lanier. And as always, I am joined by Mr. Anti-Apple himself, Chris Fox. How's it going,
Hey,
Chris?
And I did post a good anti-Apple story this week.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about some more. We're going to kind of go back to the whole security thing again, because Google actually released a beta tool yesterday, which is really kind of interesting. That I'm actually curious how it would work with email other than Gmail, to be honest with you. And then there's another Intel bug. Apparently, as always, there's always an Intel bug.
And then the fun thing about this Intel bug is there's no way for them to fix it in software.
Yeah, and then of course there's the Apple one that you just mentioned. So we're going to talk a little bit more about security, just some things that came up, and like that stuff. It's going to be an ongoing topic, apparently, because the world of security and stuff is always changing. So
it's broken. Everything's broken.
It really does seem that way. But we will start off with a couple of interesting news. It looks like Microsoft is creating Windows. What was the old Windows called? Windows RT? This looks like they're making Windows RT again.
It was Windows S, remember?
Yeah,
it went to S mode, and then...
Well, even before that...
Then it became Andromeda, and now it's Windows Lite.
Yeah. So it's like they're going to make a new version of Windows for, like, Chromebook-like devices. Not necessarily for a Chromebook, but just for a device. It's like... Similar in specs and price to a Chromebook, I guess.
And I think one of the neat things that's coming out of this is this actually goes back a long time. This goes back to the Microsoft Lumia phone days, because the last version of Windows 10 that was released for the Lumia phones used a piece of Windows called C Shell, which was their composable shell, which basically was a responsive shell. It would change how it looked based on the size of the device and whatnot.
And then that had to do with the continuum.
Well, no, it was part of it. Continuum was originally a bolt-on, and then they migrated into C Shell. So yeah, and this was also what the Courier project was using. If you remember seeing that device,
yes, I do. In fact, the article that we're going to link to has like pictures of that device.
Oh, cool, man! So. I wanted that device.
But hey, you might get it with these new foldable screens that are coming out with these new Samsung and Huawei. Well, you'll never get the Huawei phone in America, but you could possibly You could possibly get the Samsung Fold for the ridiculous price of $2,000, but that's okay. It'll come down eventually. So.
Oh, yeah. It's first.
But it is an interesting concept, a folding phone. I don't see the appeal of it, but that's just me.
See, if I could have a device that was the size of my Note 9, or even a little larger than my Note 9 folded, that I could open up and use as a laptop, I'm actually a huge fan of the converged device market. Hence, I was a Continuum user on Windows Phone.
Well, just go get you one of those Danger Sidekicks from T-Mobile back in the day. That has a little screen.
Well,
that
no. I want it to be able. I know, but I want to be able to use it as my only device.
Yeah, but you're kind of there with that whole DeX platform too.
Yeah, and it's gotten really good. In fact, I couldn't wait for Verizon to push out the update, so I went and found the firmware to push out to my phone for the latest update. And they've made some pretty great improvements to DeX. I think they've actually got it where it's not painful to use, and that's actually saying something. Now, I wish it wasn't all Android based, but
yeah. That's the thing. I want a device that, an iPad or an iPhone, that it's running iOS when it's undocked, and when you dock it, it basically runs like something like macOS. But
yeah, or in fact, on the Google side of things, if it was Chrome OS that had a good UI for using a phone, so when you docked it, it was a full Chrome OS experience with the Linux apps and everything.
But it's very interesting about this whole Windows Lite thing. I mean, this is something they needed to do. They needed to make some version of Windows that runs better on that SD card that they put in these cheap devices for schools.
eMMC.
I mean, it is dreadful running Windows 10 on that stuff. And but it always goes back to the whole thing with Microsoft. Is it too little, too late? I mean, that just seems to be our growing thing. Because with Chromebooks,
I think so.
With Chromebooks so much in education right now, and even not in education, I know people that are just like, they need a new computer. All they need to do is browse the web. So they go buy a Chromebook, and they are perfectly happy.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing that now. I mean they could become good enough, yeah. Especially with Android app support. And for those really techie people, they can have their Linux app support in certain models.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing 95% of what people do on a computer. And it's just cool. I like them. But I mean, it's interesting. Microsoft needs to get in something. They need that low-cost device to appease to those Office 365 customers. And had something like this been out 5 years ago when we all switched to Google G Suite, I mean, we might be having a different conversation. We might be mainly talking about Office 365 a lot of things.
And to be fair, it's not a bad product. And sometimes we've talked about that before, regretting decisions we've made. But
yeah, I even put on Twitter yesterday, I think, that it's like, I miss using Exchange, but I don't miss managing it.
Yeah.
All I know is
that very first screenshot in that article, God, I hope they don't center the start button.
Yeah, that seems to be the going thing now, though, isn't it? Just put everything in the middle of the screen.
That's not Windows.
No, it needs to be on the side.
And please don't make it a gesture only.
Yeah, and they don't need to be gestures only because accessibility, you know?
If I have a mouse, by golly, I shouldn't have to swipe up with the cursor.
They need buttons. But, I mean, it's interesting. I would be curious to get one to play with it. I mean,
absolutely. And I think what would be very smart of Microsoft to do, and I hope they're listening because they really need to do this, Windows Lite needs to be free.
Yeah, no kidding.
It needs to be free. That would be the only way they could disrupt the market with it, because all these machines that are already deployed could be redeployed with Windows Lite, and then they could just kind of migrate into their online system and they'd get those subscriptions still.
Yeah.
And
give it away free.
At least free to education or whatnot, because that's where they're bleeding.
Give it away free and then make a very convenient tool to reflash a Chromebook with Windows Lite.
So. Yes. And in fact, Google has got those certification processes to where they have certain Chromebooks that can run Windows now.
Yeah, because they did that whole thing where they can dual boot. So
yep.
That's
but I don't even care if they do it on that aspect. As long as they gave it away for desktop PCs, because I know, believe it or not, there's people still running Windows 7 out there.
Yes,
and Windows 7 support ends in January of next year.
Yeah, and so I've got a lot to change over. Hopefully this summer I can get the majority of Windows 7 out of here. But, you know, it's not like it's going to quit working. I'm just not going to get any updates for it. So
No security updates. And there was a bad one that came out this week for Windows 7 that's already been out in a while, too.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's always a zero-day exploit that's coming out.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I wish they would have had this out 5 years ago. I wish they would have had a low-cost device that ran Windows. It was supported with Azure and Office 365. And I wish that they would have had Microsoft Classroom out, because that was the big kickers. It's like we had Chromebook and we had Google Classroom. And that was the thing that really, to me, in my opinion, that really pushed education over the edge.
And the thing is, they have great software services now for education. I mean, OneNote for Classroom is phenomenal.
Yes.
But I'm still worried that this is going to be too late for this product. I mean, because they're not even going to talk about it till May.
Yeah. Which it really needs to come out sooner, because you're talking like we
I
buy,
need to be able to plan for stuff before May.
Yeah, we buy next year's labs and devices and stuff in like April is when we buy stuff. And then things start coming in May. And then we start deploying in June and July.
Yeah.
So it's like,
and they need to actually hurry up on something. I mean, I know they got a lot of people working on their Chrome browser now.
I wonder if we're going to be able to get more like group policy control over that browser.
Oh, dude, we're going to have all sorts of control over it.
Because it's going to be based on Chrome.
What I'm really interested in
port the
is
tools.
I won't have to load Chrome.
That's true. I mean, just
why
use,
do I need to load it? I already have it.
Just use Edge, as long as everything works in it.
It is Chromium. I mean, it's going to work identically.
It's just, I guess you just lose the whole the Chrome sync to sync people's extensions and things like that. And just
this is true.
The extensions that we do use in the classroom, the very few that we actually use. And then it's like we had that meeting and I made the comment to Spencer. I was like, I can't take anybody serious that has like 20 extensions running on their Chrome. And he opened up his browser and he's got like 35 tabs open and half the screen is full of extensions. I'm like, dude, that's way too much. I was like, do you have any RAM to do anything else?
I have one extension and it's only because it's forced on me from the appliance for our filtering.
Yeah. I have like AdBlock Plus and maybe like one more for like the shell thing or something like that. So I use very, very little extensions.
And you shouldn't use a bunch. No, I'm talking about you, Jana.
Yeah. It's just so many. But granted, there are some really cool things out there it can do, but let's just be honest. I mean, they're just shortcuts to websites.
For the most part, the majority of them. And one of the reason that I have such a beef on extensions is when I go to troubleshoot something, it makes it more difficult because there's one extra layer that's actually able to modify the page that the people are viewing. And most of the time, it ends up being a problem with an extension when there's an issue.
Yeah, that's the first thing I do whenever somebody says they're having a problem in Chrome. I go disable all the extensions and I turn them on one by one and I see what breaks it. And then I take that one away.
Yep.
And then sometimes you have that they've installed something that's not a Chrome extension, but it's like a plugin thing, and that interferes with things. And
so the coupon printers?
Or that, or like this teacher had like Real Player video download or something installed. And
why does that still exist?
I don't know. But I showed her this other app that I think works a lot better, and it's free. It can download from YouTube and other video sites a lot better, and it's not kind of hacky. So
I just show everybody the SS trick.
Yeah. And Microsoft needs to get, I mean, it ain't gonna work for them, but they should do this.
No, unfortunately it's not, but they need to get it in gear and get moving.
Yeah. And looks like we're having a two things with USB are happening.
I'm so excited about this one.
USB 3 and 3.1 are going to get rebranded under the same spec of 3.2.
That's stupid, but I like what happens next.
And then we're getting USB 4. And based on kind of the link in the document, it's in a way going open source in a way.
Intel is finally opening the Thunderbolt spec. So USB 4 will be Thunderbolt.
So that's good. Everybody,
this is the best thing that ever happened.
Because Thunderbolt has easily been kind of a Mac specific thing for a while. Some other vendors have done it. Apple's
been very prevalent in it, but it's Intel's baby.
Yeah, Intel did it. And what was it used to be called before Thunderbolt? It was something weird.
No, it was Thunderbolt always.
And it was like 10 gig and then 20 gig, and now it's going to be like 40 gig. And so,
But basically, great. Thunderbolt just encapsulates PCI Express.
Yeah.
Which is phenomenal.
And it's always kind of confusing because Thunderbolt 2,
it used a DisplayPort connector.
Yeah. Okay. Thunderbolt 3, what's out now, uses the USB-C connector, and so it's always a little confusing, especially when it comes to like the Mac lineup, because you have like the MacBook, just called the MacBook, and it's got a USB-C port, and then you have the MacBook Pros and the MacBook Airs and the other Macs, the desktop Macs, they have Thunderbolt 3 ports, which is also a USB-C. So now they can actually take some of the confusion away and just make it all USB 4.
I think what led to the confusion is a lot of people didn't realize that USB has a physical spec and a protocol spec. So our Type A is a physical spec. Our Type B is a physical spec. Our Type C is a physical spec, and they still had their USB 1, 2, 3, 3.1 on top of that, because you could run USB 1 on a USB Type-C connector if you really wanted.
Yeah. It just requires you to make dongles or make a new cable that's just USB 1.
It's just one of those things. People see the physical connector and associate it with, hey, this has got to be Thunderbolt. I had a phone that was USB 2 that used a USB-C connector.
Yeah, and you know, I'm kind of guilty of that too, because I see USB 3 and I'm just thinking the old blue. I'm just thinking about blue cables. You know, everything's blue in the USB cable, and so I'm thinking, okay, 3.1. I don't associate that in my mind as C. I just think, okay, well, that's just a faster 3.
They just can adopt a different connector.
It's just a different connector, and I'm glad that they're sticking with the same C connector, so that even though the spec is changing, so maybe that'll keep backwards compatibility. I guess it's kind of like when it went from 1 to 2, it kept the same connector. I hope this one sticks around a lot better. I mean, it looks better. It's smaller. I mean, isn't that the goal, to make it smaller and
smaller, more durable, where you don't have to try to plug it in 6 times.
Yeah. And so
flip.
Yeah. So it's like Intel's going to open that up. And so that we can get some more Thunderbolt products to utilize that cool spec.
What I'm really excited about is, because it is just PCI Express, all those Thunderbolt solutions that actually work on AMD chips now can be legitimized.
Yeah. So because it's not going to be an Intel specific thing anymore. So.
Yep. And it's a good thing. Now, one thing to keep in mind, Thunderbolt has another specification, and USB 4 is going to have it as well, to where it's not going to be directly connected to the PCI bus. It has to go through another chipset.
Yeah.
So, and this is an issue that I've always had with like those external graphics cards. People don't realize it's not connecting in there. You're introducing quite a bit of latency. So yes, you have that bandwidth, but you're actually, if you're using something high throughput like a GPU, you might as well cut your theoretical bandwidth in half, because it has to go through that other chipset.
Yeah.
And the limitation's still going to be there, but it's still going to be way better than USB.
Yeah, and I just want them to standardize on a cable too, because
Everything should be USB-C at this point. And honestly, there's no reason they couldn't do it.
But I just...
Lightning. You need to go away.
Yeah, and you know, I'm to the point now, I just kind of agree. I just really want one cable to rule them all at this point. I don't really want dongles, but I know that's the way everything's going to be.
Well, we're going to have dongles with this still, because old stuff exists.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I'm not going to go buy a new, twice as expensive new external hard drive just because it's got a different connector on the end of it.
Yeah, or your monitors, probably not. Most monitors don't have USB-C on them yet.
Yeah, and so, it'll be interesting. I know it's a slow process getting everything changed over. Everybody's just used to the old stuff, and nobody likes change. So, I mean, that's just the way life goes. Things change, things get better. So,
What's interesting too is I think Thunderbolt is PCI Express 3, and 4 is actually being implemented right now, and 5's already been standardized. So. We've already got some pretty, so it looks like if they keep the way the specs usually go, PCI Express 2.0 with Thunderbolt was 20 gig, 3.0, 40 gig, 4.0, 80 gig, 5.0, 160 gig.
Oh, man, that's just.
So you can see how, I mean, because that's how PCI Express moves, it double.
Man, when I got this new MacBook Pro, I purposely went out and bought the Thunderbolt cable to migrate from my old Mac to my new Mac. And my old Mac had Thunderbolt 1, which is only 10 gig, and my new one has Thunderbolt 2, which was 20. But even then, it's like the amount of time that it took to transfer and migrate my data over that 10 gig connection was amazing. I mean, I purposely went out. It's like, I'm going to go buy this $40 cable just so I can do this one task. Just because it's like the only opportunity that at the time, really, there was nothing else Thunderbolt other than like you'd hook up a monitor, and it really wasn't even Thunderbolt. It was mini display. So I took that time. I took that opportunity just to see. And dude, it was amazing. I mean, it was just amazingly fast. I'm glad that speeds are getting up, and I can just, and pretty soon we're going to be limited to the speed of flash. We're going to be, the drives are going to be the bottleneck again at some point.
I mean, mechanical drives have been the bottleneck for a while now, cheap SSDs have been bottlenecked,
and so we're moving the flash, which is faster than the spinny drives, which USB 3 can, I guess, kind of keep up with. I think it's like 5 gigabits per second or something like that, and so it's like the USB 3 spec can keep up with SSDs when doing it, but now like. Even your top-of-the-line flash is going to be a bottleneck whenever we get to 80 gigs and 160 gigabytes per second. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. But that just means flash memory is going to get even faster. So everybody's going to be better.
But I say we've already got Optane, and we need to abandon NAND memory anyway. It's too fragile.
Yeah,
we need to move to something better.
So, and then Intel has a flaw in a CPU.
Hey, more Intel news.
Yeah,
not so good Intel news.
And
hey, spoiler alert.
What's that?
That's actually what it's called.
Oh, spoiler alert. Yeah. And so Intel, as it seems, they're just never going to be. They just need to give it up. Let's just scratch the table, start over, and let's see if we can do this again.
They need to completely re-architect how they're doing speculative execution.
I mean, what is
That's
the
what
answer?
They got to do.
What is the answer, really? I mean,
see, AMD and ARM don't have this in their versions of speculative execution.
It's just
because it's just how Intel implemented it. But you remember how much faster Intel was back in the day when this implemented.
Yeah.
I mean, they were leaps and I mean, they were 5 years ahead of everyone.
Yeah.
And apparently they took some shortcuts, though.
Yeah. And now it's coming back to bite them.
Yeah.
So it's,
I mean, this is going to cost a lot of money to fix. It's not one of those things that they can't patch this in software. This one is just not possible.
This one's just redesigned hardware.
Yeah, you got a new. You have a new silicon,
which makes me wonder: is this the reason why Intel is having trouble making certain processors right now?
Well, no, that's just because they put a lot of money in 10 nanometer and it's failed on them all kinds. Their lithography. In AMD and the ARM companies, they don't have that issue because they don't manufacture their own stuff. They're using TSMC and GlobalFoundries.
Yeah.
And all they do is lithography, so.
But yeah, it's just crazy.
Yeah, Intel's got a lot of baskets that they work in, though. I don't think people realize how many different things that the company actually does.
The leakage can be exploited by a limited set of instructions. So that means it's not hard to do,
no.
Which is visible in all Intel generations, starting with the first generation of Intel Core processors, which... You know, Core 2 Duos and all those old ones. Everything's affected, independent of the OS, and also works within virtual machines and sandbox environments.
Yes, here's the scariest part. This security shortcoming can potentially be exploited by malicious JavaScript within a browser tab.
That's just insane. That this is just
and
this is
it
a bad
can
one.
Execute. Yeah, it can actually access the encrypted parts of memory.
Man, this is rough. This makes me want to just buy AMD and nothing else. So
hey, I'm AMD. Or you can use your ARM stuff. You can use your Apple A series.
Yeah, it's like I'd kind of love an ARM based Mac. I just need it powerful enough to run Logic. That's all.
You're not going to get that for a little while.
And Day of Defeat Source. That's all I needed to do.
Yeah, that's never going to happen.
Let me tell you, man. I'm a little bit worried about Day of Defeat Source. This is the last version of macOS that's going to support running 32-bit apps. And every once in a while when I'm firing up my game, it tells me that this app is not optimized and may not work in future versions of macOS.
Yeah, just virtualize it.
So it just makes me sad that I might actually have to build me a PC so I can play my game. So, and then, but speaking of Apple... apparently, you can run an app that doesn't require admin permissions and steal all your passwords out of keychain. And Apple doesn't seem to give a crap about it. So,
no, because they weren't a registered person to be looking for problems. So we don't believe you.
Yeah, it's just I think that's the thing that boggles my mind. It doesn't surprise me that there is the possibility of an app that can steal Mac passwords. That doesn't surprise me at all because software writers are human. Humans make mistakes. Things happen. I get that. That's not a big deal. But the thing that boggles my mind the most is, like, in this article, the person that found this claims that Apple has an invite-only bug bounty program. And I'm like,
they do.
What good is that? I mean, it's like we're only going to let people we trust look for bugs in our software.
Well, I mean, it's not. I mean, yeah, that's the payout program. But they should still listen to people that are not in it.
Yeah, I just don't know. And so that's the thing that boggles my mind. I mean, there's a bug for everything. Everything's got bugs. I get that. And it's going to happen. But
bugs in keychains and anything cryptography are extremely bad.
Yeah. And it's like, even if it was fake, even if I was to like put something on YouTube or contact Apple and be like, look, I have this app. I can get your Mac passwords. And it's not hard to do. I mean, even if I was lying to them, You think because you're talking about encrypted stuff and passwords, and because I use iCloud Keychain Library and I love it. I love the keychain because it's just everything syncs. It's great. I have my passwords everywhere. It's built into the OS's. But this is potentially bad. And so, like, you would think that anything that had to do with passwords, like my bank account password is saved. I'm not going to lie. I'm not typing that big, long thing out. That's ridiculous. But I'm the only one that uses my computer and my devices. And you need my face to be able to, or my computer password to be able to access that thing. But if there's this app.
Or this program.
Yeah. But it's like, you would think they would take it seriously, even if the guy was lying. It's like you would think that there should be somebody that's just going to like question it, investigate it, check it out, see what's going on, just because it has to do with the keychain.
I think it's very telling to the future of Apple when Apple's bug bounty initiative is invite only and it's only for iOS. They really don't care about macOS.
Yeah.
macOS is not going to be here very long.
Yeah,
that's exactly what that says.
Yeah, no matter what they keep trying to say in the press and pushing out these new Macs, which don't get me wrong, they're gorgeous, even though the keyboard is terrible, and the new Mac Mini.
And they have horrible thermals.
Yeah, it's just, or the stage light displays.
Wait, there's a lot of, or they're pretty, but they don't work really well, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't really think they care about the Mac as much. I mean, if they cared so much about the Mac, why are they doing Project Marzipan, where they're porting iOS apps over? I mean.
Well, they don't. I mean, it's obvious.
It's coming. And you know, I would be fine with running iOS on a laptop device. iOS is a great product. I mean, don't get me wrong. I wish it was a little bit more capable, even on my iPad. I mean, on the phone, it's fine. But on the iPad, with the better hardware, I'd like to be able to do a little bit more. I'd like cursor support.
Actual file system?
Yeah, I mean, I just like to be able to do more things with it. I would love for my iPad to be my only computer. I mean, I've made mention of that lots of times. But it's got a long way to go. And then there's the whole rumors of macOS running on ARM. I don't think that's the case. I think they're going to make iOS laptops is what I think they're going to do.
Exactly.
But I hope I'm wrong because I like macOS too. I like it for the things that it allows me to do that I can't do on iOS. But for the fact that their bug bounty is only iOS, like you said, and it's invite only, it's like they don't care about the macOS. They don't care about the bugs. I mean, in fact, there's also another article that Google found a zero-day exploit in macOS kernel. So they just came out this week.
But those are a shared kernel.
Yeah, and so it's just, I wonder if Google's a part of their invite-only thing. So
it depends on what mood they're in.
Yeah, they might just kick them out of the app store for a day.
I know. I don't think Google should be part of it. I think they should just release it all to the public.
And as we finish up today, I want to talk about something that Google did yesterday or the day before, which I think is great. It's moving in the right direction of solving the email problem. They have, for G Suite people, and apparently there is a G Suite update blog. I didn't know about this until I saw this link. And so I was like, well, I'm going to subscribe to this blog because I want to know about the new things coming to G Suite. They added this thing called confidentiality mode or confidential mode in Gmail, which basically it's like a little toggle you can set. And you have some options. I mean, they're very like small options right now. You can set a time limit on the access of this email. Like it can only be accessible for a certain amount of time or things like that. Or you can actually set it to do, you have to get an SMS code in order to open the email, which to me, this solves part of the problem as far as like going through like the encryption part of, it's like they're doing the encryption for you. Without having to get like a PGP code that's costing money.
PGP was great.
Yeah, but it costs money and so nobody wanted to do it.
Well, no, it's free, GPG.
Well, I know, but you still had to go do an extra step. People don't want to do the extra step. They don't want to they don't want to have to send people their code that they have to put into something else.
Well, I wonder if they're going to want to do this.
Yeah, well, here's my thing. How is this going to work outside of Gmail?
Well, it's kind of like how you get those messages from like your insurance agency or your bank where you get a link that actually goes to another service that you have to open the message in.
Yeah, that's kind of how I figured it would do. But
it's the only way they can. They have to retain ownership of the information.
But this, to me, is a great thing because it's solving one good thing. This could actually potentially solve the whole having to fax student records from out of state over fax. I mean, we could just use
Or you could just email them. Encrypt the zip. Do something.
Yeah, put a password on the zip file. But it's like, this just sort of makes it a little bit easier. It's like you just click a button, makes them require a code, and then they have to get an SMS. But I wonder how that's all going to work too, because is it going to have like the... Because obviously you can't just have a link that says enter your phone number to get the code to enter this email. So if anybody gets a hold of that email, they can just put whatever phone number in. So it's almost like you'd have to have a phone number registered to your Google account. And that's that's the code that it would send it to.
But you can choose no SMS or SMS with it, and you can just have the link expire.
Yeah, and so it's just neat. It's a start.
It's a good step.
It's a start, and that's what... That's all I wanted, was a start, because email is an old technology. Nothing's really been implemented. In fact, some things that Google does makes it worse with their IMAP implementation.
What IMAP implementation?
Their fake IMAP. So I'm kind of excited about this. I don't like the way you got to turn it on, because it's an all or nothing thing right now. I'd like to only be able to turn it on for certain users, not for the entire domain. Because I don't want kids to be playing with this right now. I just want to be playing with it.
I wonder how that does work with Vault.
They actually have another blog that they posted at the same time that Vault has been updated to be able to handle these
accessible
messages.
From if the sender is within your organization, that's good.
So it will be able to capture the Vault. Vault will be able to capture these emails as well. So they did both of those at the same time. They literally had the same timestamp on my RSS reader when I added the blog. So, I mean, it's like they posted them both at the same time. It's crazy. It's a right step. It's a good step in the right direction as far as like getting email a little bit more secure. Like I said, I'm curious how it's going to work with other platforms. I wish they could make it work without having to go to another link or go to another system. It's like,
yeah, there's no way they're going to be able to do that though.
I mean, even if the person doesn't have, if you're sending to a non Gmail account, I'm just curious how that's going to work. I mean,
they're going to have to go to a Google service link.
Yeah. And so, which of course at first is probably going to freak people out.
Is this real?
Just like, you remember how gray listing freaked everybody out when that came about?
I loved gray listing.
Gray listing was great, but it was such a pain.
It's still great.
It's like, if you want to email me, you have to reply to the, or if I want to even, I send somebody an email and it says, hey, if you want me to get this email, you need to reply to this email with like reply and like the text line or something like that.
Yeah. I enable gray listing on servers, because spam servers wouldn't try to resend the same message, but legitimate messages would try to resend.
Yeah.
It killed a lot of spam pretty instantly.
It does.
Until the spammers decided, hey, why don't we just retry once?
Yeah. It was great, but it was just kind of interesting to get bounce back emails that said, hey, if you want me to get your email, you got to do this. I'm like, maybe, you know what? Come think of it. Maybe I don't want you to get my email. if you're making me do an extra step. But that's the whole thing, right? Nobody wants to do anything extra.
I think we need to adopt, and as far as the state goes, I mean, they're already centrally housing our Texas stuff and most SMSs. They just need to say, hey, this is what we're going to use. This is where you're going to go to get it. That way they already have all the records there.
Yeah.
There would be no human error introduced into it because the records would be there.
Yeah.
When a student enrolls, it just turns that flag, hey, the student's here. So their records are visible to you there. You don't have to worry about someone sending it or not sending the correct stuff or not sending enough of it.
Yeah,
so
you kind of got
it with T-Rex, but you still have to do something.
I mean, when you think about that, it's like we all have to take the same standardized test, which is a sham, apparently.
We're required to use one of two SMS programs.
So why not just have a state-owned SMS directory
that's what they need to do.
That houses all the student. You can have different business stuff because those are actually two separate products. They don't really even have to communicate with each other. You can have your own business product, but then like you said, it's like this student is enrolled in Orangefield. And so he shows up under Orangefield's account, or this student is enrolled at Evadale. So it shows up under Evadale's account.
And what that would solve, there would be no PIMS uploads because all the information's already there.
They could just pull it themselves. Whenever they wanted.
Whenever they wanted. There would be no kind of, there would be no shuffling of data around with private information.
Nope, because it would all be.
As long as they didn't leave the server open to the public like they've done so many times.
Yes. And it would all be centrally located. We wouldn't have to worry about backing it up. Well, I mean, maybe we should, We might could be able to do like run our own backups just to have the data. But yeah, it would make complete sense for it all to be in one place. But that would also require TEA to have more than just three people working there. So,
well, they have more than three people. They just only turn their phone system on for three people.
Yeah. So it's just, I know a while back they did like a massive layoff at TEA. So there's always made the joke that it's like there's one person working there. So,
I mean, to be quite frank, I mean, that would be a really good use of the service centers is to agree to do this and support each other in it.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah, it really would, because then you would just have all the data in one place and
cost cut.
Yep.
I mean,
that's one less product we have to buy, because you pay for both parts of your SMS and your business. You pay for both of them. So, mm-hmm. And it really should just be free. I mean,
the service centers already work for TEA in the state.
Yeah.
So why are we? I mean, it didn't make sense. The state paid those employees to write this software, which they charge the schools back to buy that software, which is all state money anyway.
Yeah, it's like the state's paying the state. So,
yeah, let's just stop that.
Yeah, and so let's just make things a little bit better. I mean, you know what? Just like hold a portion of like a reasonable portion of your budget that you assign from the state and just call it, hey, this is what's supporting the database. I mean,
this is operation cost.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's like too bad we're not in charge, right? We could come up with something. And then it's
yeah,
like,
yeah, but they'll never listen to us.
And then if every state did this, then it would, then you could just like have like some online transfer system between systems. I mean,
yeah. I mean, and they already know how to do the interchanges, right? So, I mean, they could come up with, well, they already did that. What was that open format they released years ago for student records and whatnot?
I don't know.
You remember what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about, but I can't remember the name.
We just agree to use the open format when we send between systems.
Yeah, or, and that's the thing. We got to set up to be able to send between systems so that we don't have to fax the information.
Yes, we just need to agree.
And we would get all that information, all that enrollment information via email. And it would also have to be able to build in like some checks and balances as far as like if somebody tries to enroll a kid in two schools.
And
it needs to notify
the
person.
They do that now already.
Yeah.
Like when you do star stuff, it'd be like, hey, this kid's already registered here.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just.
So they're doing it because they do have that state unique ID now.
Yeah. And so we just need to put everything in one system and everybody accesses that one system. Or even if we had to keep using Texas, just let Texas access that database. Like let that be a front end to it, and let Skyward access that database, let PowerSchool and all these other SISs that people use be able to access that database. And so,
yeah, I'm down for it.
So, but that's our show for this week. For links and show notes for this episode, you can visit educatingtech.net/64. Oh, and just a heads up, the website may change pretty soon. I know I'm going to have to fix some links. Simplecast is doing an update to version 2.0, which is going to be able to let us do SSL on our own domain. I guess they're jumping on bandwidth with the Let's Encrypt method. This is what I'm sure they're doing, like GitHub and everybody else has the ability to do. So you might see some changes. You might see some downtime. As far as the communication that I've gotten from Simplecast, the feed and the downloads and everything should still work during the changeover. We'll get a new RSS feed, but the old one will link to the new one. But all I have to do is just go change it in FeedBurner, because that is what I submit to everything, is the FeedBurner address. It's supposed to build in like some, be able to submit to Spotify a lot easier and some other things. I think maybe Google Podcast, things like that. So looking forward to getting that. So you might see some changes and some minor downtime in the near future when that migration. It's supposed to be like mid-March. Everybody's supposed to be finished. So just wanted to give that heads up. I'm just waiting on my button that says migrate, and then I'll click it and go from there.
And we'll click it because...
Why not? Why not, right? But you can send us any questions, comments, or concerns. And if you like our idea of how we should change the state SIS system, to educatingtech@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on Twitter at educatingtech. And in the show notes, you can also find a link to our Discord, where you can come and talk about the episodes or just chat with us about certain things, or if there's anything we can help you with. You can follow Chris on Twitter at @feeks, and I'm @twistofmatt. And if you like what we're doing, you can support us by going to Patreon.com. patreon.com/educatingtech and leaving us a rating and a review in Apple Podcasts to help us grow our audience. I don't know if Spotify allows us to leave ratings or not, or if Google Podcasts has enabled that, but if they do, you can do that there too, and somebody on those platforms can see us. Next week, I am on spring break. I am going to attempt to make all efforts to be able to record with you next week, Chris. I will bring everything I need home from the office because we do this during some downtime or after school. So I will make sure I bring my microphone home so we don't miss next week. Should be able cool. to.
Yeah, I'll be here all week.
Yeah, you got to, you have the winter break and the spring break, and you have to work one of the two, right?
Is that the Actually, one? No, I don't have to work either of them here, but our spring break is not for until April.
Oh, yeah, because y'all had the winter break.
We had a winter break in February, too.
You know, we are on that District of Innovation thing, and I kind of wish we did that. But we do a thing where, like, the students get the Monday after the end of the 6 weeks off.
Yeah, we do that too.
How is this possible?
It's all based on hours, not days.
Yeah, and so we do like an early release on the Friday, and then they're off on Monday, and we do like a staff development on those Mondays, which I kind of wish we could just gather up all those days and have just 2 weeks off, like a spring break and a winter break. But I am not the guy who makes the decisions on the calendar because – I would probably make the decision. It's like, let's go to school for a month. Let's have a week off. Let's go to school for a month. Let's have a week off. Let's go to school for a month.
I'm going for that too.
And we just have a week off every month, and we just go year round, and we just never stop. But like I said, people like their summer breaks, and I'm not in charge of the calendar. But that's it for this week. We'll see you next time, Chris.
All right. See you later, Matt.